Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to 42 Minutes. Today, this is Doug Bowles, a writer from the Think Book, joined by Morgan, William Morgan, and Justin Gray Morgan. Justin is the designer who did the cover for the Think Book. And as if you've been listening to any of Alan's pimp casts, he's been doing a lot of pimp casts for the Think Book. You'll hear that how he, Justin, came to be part of the project with the Think Book, which is he got into a weird sync with Alan. Alan said, "Hey, I'm doing this book," and then Justin said, "Well, I have to do the cover," and. And then that was history. And then I met him this past summer.
I've got a question real quick. You bring up a good point. I mean, I heard Alan talk about, you know, how Justin asked to do the cover of the Think Book. But, Justin, what was it that you really synced with Alan to make you want to get in contact with him?
Well, yeah, that would be quite a long story. But... it was really just mind-blowing. I was actually doing some freelance work out here in San Francisco at the magazine Juxtapose. And I was waiting on a friend of mine who was working there to get out of a meeting. So he takes a notorious long time and was kind of procrastinating. And so I just started searching around randomly on the internet. I watched The Watchmen recently. At that time, and there were a couple books in the movie that I kind of noticed. They zoomed in particularly close on one that was called Under the Hood, which was kind of a book written within the comic book. And then the other one was, I believe it was Ramses 2. So I was just trying to look up some things about those books within the movie, you know, because they kind of made it obviously clear they were trying to emphasize those, although it was only on the screen for a few seconds. So I'm not sure exactly how I got onto Alan's blog, but for those who have read the Think Book, this was a couple weeks after the experiences that I write about in my piece for the Think Book. So it was a very kind of secretive time, a lot of...
Hey, Justin, the part that you wrote in the Think Book actually takes place right before you were introduced to Alan?
Yeah, it does, actually. And
oh, that's
so it was, stuff was so synchronistic at that time, it was kind of hard to condense it all down into a piece for the book. But I just kind of met this new girl that I've fallen in love with. A lot of interesting kind of meditational breakthroughs happening at that time and some interesting artistic things going on, but it would be hard to go through all the details, but I found this old post called The Birds and the Bees Part 3 that Alan wrote, and it deals with Kurt Vonnegut's book Titans of Siren or Sirens of Titan, which actually was kind of used or at least influenced Alan Moore's Watchmen. A pretty interesting book, if people haven't checked it out, I would recommend doing so. But when I was reading the blog post, there were so many just little things, like little jokes I'd been making with my girlfriend, things I'd read recently, places I'd been going. There was like three sirens and three graces statues, you know, at places I'd been hanging out at. And I literally, when I was reading the post, was just kind of looking around. I was like, is this some kind of joke on me? Like my friend is playing, you know, while I'm waiting for him to get out of the meeting, you know, like how is this blog, you know, like have so much stuff that is going on or relating to what's going on in my life at the time. So I usually don't comment on blogs or things like that, but I just wrote a little comment like, whoa, this is wild, man. I appreciate you taking the time to write this because it unpacked a lot of real interesting information. And yeah, since then we just started talking and then ended up writing a brief thing just in response to one of his other blogs, because after we started communicating, a lot of just other real interesting synchronicities occurred. And, yeah, then we ended up working together. It's been it's been interesting, and the syncs kind of continue as far as the stuff that he is writing about regularly on his blog, kind of paralleling a lot of what I've been working on or experiencing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I did read yours, and, you know, a lot of people's in the sync book is speculative, but like you said, yours is more meditative. And it actually, I gotta thank you because it kind of helped me. Like, in my own meditation, there's one part in there where you're talking about, like, bouncing from your foot to your head and back again to, like, speed up the vibration. And I had never done that before. And I immediately benefited from it, if that makes any sense. You know what I'm talking about? Do you know what part I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I maybe have a little bit of a different take on sync. Not a different take on sync itself, but a lot of people, there's a lot of synchronistic writing about movies and things like that. And I think whatever you're participating in, synchronicities will kind of occur
right
in that, you know?
It's kind of like
living in a city. I'm sorry, go ahead, Doug.
No, I was just going to say, I see what you're saying. It's kind of like, once you raise to a certain awareness, like, you participate with synchronicities in whatever you're doing. I mean, it's almost like a matter of temperament or you know, just what you want to meditate on, really. Because, I mean, all you're really doing is becoming aware. When you're meditating, you're becoming aware. And so when you're meditating and watching a movie or you raise that awareness through psychedelics or whatever, I mean, it's an awareness. So whatever you're participating in, the general, like, theme of sync will bleed through. It's just a matter of temperament, what you want to actually focus on.
Well, so here's...
What
is your perception of what, like, the sync community does, and then how would you be different, Justin?
Yeah, I've kind of been thinking about this in regard to just kind of preparing for this conversation. To some extent, I think that what is referred to as sync, like what people commonly call sync, of finding these narratives through, like, collective, narratives through media, I almost would call, like, macro media mythology. Because you're kind of scanning media itself as a whole and then finding these archetypal narratives within them, and particular people kind of sync up with particular archetypal characters. There certainly is an aspect, and I have this happen a lot too, of just very synchronistic things within shows or movies. You know, you might be thinking about a particular thing, and then something on the screen happens that just almost kind of answers a question or idea that you were thinking about. Excuse me.
Yeah, I agree. But like your piece illustrates, though, I mean, what you were experiencing in your just, you know, city street walk kind of bled through into what was going on inside your head at the time. I mean, when you're talking about the labyrinth and everything. Because it was almost like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's almost a journal in a way. I mean, in your experience of, you know, what was going on inside your head while you're walking through this, like, maze park in the city. And, you know, I've heard a lot about it. Do you think of it as you take sync walks? That's a common phrase. People know what that means.
Yeah, I actually do. And I've had just almost insanely awesome, like, results from doing kind of sync walk things. I guess, like, my take on what I think a sync walk is, or synchronicity in general, I think it's almost allowing, like, a bit of a higher consciousness aspect of yourself to kind of take over. So this was maybe, like, a couple weeks after the events I write about for the sync book and kind of contacting Alan and stuff. Molly and I were going into downtown San Francisco, and we ate at this restaurant, and then we're like, well, let's just walk around, you know. Let's doesn't necessarily call it a sync walk, but we're like, let's just walk around and let our intuition kind of guide us. And so it was nice to kind of walk with someone else, because it added another layer to walking through the city, you know. Like, I would be like, well, let's walk this way, and then she would notice something that I would have missed otherwise. So we ended up kind of snaking through downtown San Francisco, end up walking into Chinatown, and kind of going through a couple of stores. And I'm walking past this one storefront in Chinatown, and Molly's like, well, let's go in here. This is a tea shop, you know. I would have just walked right past it. So we go walking in. We walk in, and the shop is completely empty except for, like, this large group of, like, big, tall black guys at the back of the store. And Molly's walking over towards the side, looking at teas, and I, like, grab her. I'm like, do you know who that is over there? And she's like, her face just turns white. She's like, Wu-Tang Clan. And Ghostface Killah and Killah Priest and U-God and, like, a couple other members of Wu-Tang Clan. We're in a tea shop in Chinatown.
Holy shit.
Which, you know, it is chance coincidence, but we were just walking around, you know, like, well, let's walk around and see what we can find. And that wasn't necessarily, like, the most meaningful thing ever, but it was had to be, like, the best place to ever see Wu-Tang Clan in a tea shop in Chinatown.
That's cool. But, no, I mean, I consider that valid. Like, to me, it's not necessarily even, like, a search for enlightenment. Sometimes if you're just kind of following your, you know, intuition like that, you're just in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, just for perfect little, I consider them almost like little winks or something, saying, like, yeah, this is the right little place to go. And the way we handled that walk was we would we'd get to a cross section and we'd just look left or right, and there would be something intriguing to the left, so we'd go that way, you know. And interesting things end up happening that way.
Have you been listening to some of the conversations we've been having here, Justin, at all?
I have, yeah. I have.
So, do you have anything
maybe
to
the
add?
Past three.
Well, it seems like we really, for a while, been kind of bogged down in the idea of cosmology, you know, and the difference between, like, an active cosmology where the hero has an adventure that they have to undertake, or more of a passive cosmology where the hero is a mystic and they need to let go of all their baggage so the world can become free. Do you have anything to add to that? Or, and then maybe we'll get into your... Go ahead.
Yeah. For philosophical, I mean, this, not that this is kind of a cop-out in some ways, but I think the answer is both and then also neither, you know? Like, as far, it's kind of, I guess, relates almost to what we were talking about with the sync walks themselves, is that at each particular crossroads, you know, like, you just have to kind of assess the situation at that moment. So, at sometimes it's important to keep the baggage, you know, because you've learned from past experiences and you're bringing that with you. And so that's necessary. It's important at other times, you know, to totally die to all the baggage and be completely in the moment. And that's kind of what I enjoy about synchronistic experiences, is that they kind of take you deeper into the moment. And I almost find the more present I am in the moment, that the more kind of synchronicities occur.
you have any heroes?
So, I mean, there's a...
philosophies go?
Sorry?
I was just going to ask if you had yourself any heroes as far as philosophy goes. I mean, like Jung?
Yeah, of course. Jung's a big one. Joseph Campbell is a big one. One that's maybe not mentioned quite as much is Ram Dass, who was original name was Richard Alpert. He and Timothy Leary both worked at Harvard.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
Then ended up doing a lot of studies with LSD. Like, they're kind of famously ordered $500,000 of LSD using Harvard funds. And then both were fired, and Timothy Leary's story is a little more well-known in the mainstream. Ram Dass, like, declared himself as information. Like, as he resigned, he was like, well, I'm no longer really a person. I'm just information. But he had a kind of interesting story of going to India and finding a guru, which that can be kind of a loaded term, especially like with New Age stuff, that he actually found enlightened being. He explains in a book, Be Here Now, about kind of some synchronistic events that this guru like knew that he had been thinking about his mom, who had died like a year ago, like the night before he met the guru. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. He's like, oh, you were out under the stars last night thinking about your mom. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, oh, she died last year. And he's like, yeah. He's like, her stomach got real big and swollen, and she died from swollen stomach, you know. And, you know, this was the first time meeting this guy. This kind of just put him into, it kind of blew his mind. But there's a series of lectures actually recorded in Boulder, called the Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, he does like a really fantastic job of just really explaining a lot of different things. He's very funny too. But yeah, I would highly recommend people listen to that if they haven't heard it.
Okay. I got a different direction to go because I just thought of this question, but because I was looking at, you did the cover to the Sync book, you wrote your piece, you also contributed the artwork inside, especially what I wanted to focus on, because we only have like 42 minutes, was the,
sure,
the tarots in the back. You did those, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I know that you, I can tell by your piece and other things that I've seen about you, that you're pretty knowledgeable in esoteria. But I was wondering, do you don't practice magic or anything like that, especially being an artist, any, like, sigil work?
Will, you're talking to Baphomet here. Do you practice magic? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, the name was thrust upon me on the Sync Book cabin, although I did have a Baphomet shirt. And I try to do almost everything as a form of magic, or maybe rather ritual, you know? I don't necessarily try to do hocus-pocus stuff as far as, like, manifesting my will, you know? I more just go about things in a ritualized way in order to accomplish particular results, you know?
Do you know what a sigil is? An S-I-G-I-L? Have you ever heard of that before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was almost trying to create for the Sync Book cover, you know, to some extent, to put patterns and codes on the cover itself and use underlying kind of sacred geometries to like have kind of an encoded meaning or like a more sacred meaning.
Right.
And I even do that when I'm designing logos or whatnot, you know, try to use numbers with loaded meanings. And yeah, I consider even this this interview to be like a sigil of sort, you know, that you do it at the same time for the same amount of time. Every week you're creating kind of a sacred space for things to happen within.
Yeah, I think I've reached that same point where that by creating the boundaries, there's kind of this sacredness to the space, you know, having the same start time and then the same duration. And so, yeah.
Well, yeah, you have to encapsulate something. That's what somebody said one time. I think it was a quantum physicist that I heard say that. He was talking about alpha, beta. Like, you know, that's the start of the Hebrew language. Alpha is the beginning. B is actually kind of means the end. It's like the encapsulating force that contains. And you have to have, it has to be contained. The meaning has to be whittled down to a finer point. See, that's why I like comic books. Like when we're talking about like speech bubbles, you know what I mean? Like anybody who's tried to make a comic book knows they have to whittle down what the character is saying to fit it in the speech bubble. You have to contain it to get the bigger impact. You have to make a point.
I think that's a good point. And I think it's important, too, to do everything almost as like a magical act, you know, that it isn't necessarily like, it doesn't end, although like we create a good container for this to take place in, you know, like washing the dishes should be done as like a meditative kind of act, you know, to just be as fully conscious as you can and just be in the moment.
Right, and that's a nice kind of step in a direction that I kind of want to go, which is, so this week Justin sent an email to me and shared a video series that I mentioned in the introduction called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. And it kind of speaks to humanity's desire to control things, you know, so the present moment is authentic, and there's this component of it where we do kind of have to just let go to the present moment and, you know, treat it as a sacred space. But there's another part of our humanity that doesn't want that unpredictability, that we want to have a knowingness and to feel safe. You know, and so we kind of want to create an inorganic space where we can feel safe in. And well, go ahead and tell us about the video series. I don't think it's funny because I thought Will was the one who sent me the link, and so I got excited and shared it with some of the rest of the God people. It's a great series, but go ahead and tell us a little bit about it, Justin, and we'll see if I can make any sense at all.
Yeah, well, I guess my disclaimer up front is that I'm still kind of processing like the implications of the video series, but essentially it's kind of unpacking some of the underlying ways that computers have shaped the world. So I think we're all familiar with how that's happened outwardly, you know, with the emergence of networks and the World Wide Web and so-called kind of global brain and collective consciousness coming together and even manifesting outwardly as like global revolutions and this kind of non-hierarchical fantasy. And what just kind of astonished me about it was the implications of how it's affected us on an inward level. Particularly for me, like a big one is in the second one. It's talking about the, I believe the name's the use and abuse of vegetational concepts. They talk about how the idea of the ecosystem as a stable, self-regulating kind of Gaian matrix of like equilibrium is a myth that was originated by people who actually did computer work, and rather than modeling nature just in a realistic way, they simplified it and fit it to model computer networks and feedback loops and circuit boards. So from that arose the non-hierarchical ideas and kind of this like Silicon Valley fantasy of non-hierarchical existence and leadership. And what was kind of disturbing, and I think is particularly relevant, because this was released in early 2011, but he talks about these organic non-leadership revolutions happening in Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine and Georgia, and that seemingly like masses of people woke up and overthrew the government, you know, in kind of something that really mirrors Occupy Wall Street. And that in all cases, after this kind of non-hierarchy revolution occurred, they were successful and, you know, overthrew the government or had demands, and then they weren't able to organize and rule in a meaningful way. So in all cases, like a more tyrannical government actually resulted from the old hierarchies reasserting themselves in a new way. So I feel like this is like further kind of proved with what happened in Egypt, that there was this internet Occupy Wall Street type, you know, Arab Spring revolution, and then they were successful in outing the president, and now they have a military dictatorship. So it's an interesting documentary.
Yeah, well, because it kind of gets at one of the core truths that change is the state of nature, you know. So we want stability, but it's so much bigger than we can actually model in a computer. And right there, I love it when they say, and this is nature functioning like a well-oiled machine. It's like, what? You know, like the stability of nature is like a well-oiled machine. And all of a sudden we've like put this artificial concept over the top of the natural system so that our mind can, you know, understand it, because we can understand a machine. We created a machine, but nature is so much bigger that we're going to have to impose, you know, and we flatten it out. And I was having this discussion with someone about, you know, like the difference between digital and analog, where, you know, we're starting to kind of digitize everything, but we're losing just little pieces of authenticity in this flattening out of media and culture and things. But
I
think at the core of
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say at the core of maybe the clash between computers and that kind of system of arrangement is that really when you break them all the way down, that it's all binary code. So it is in the sense like this very dualistic on or off type of system, like that's really what's at the root of that, you know, and that almost kind of, they try to hide, not that it's like consciously hidden, but that it's just buried underneath like the complexity of having billions of ones and zeros, that you can start to map out complex networks and things, but really at the core there's that dualistic foundation, whereas in nature, I can't remember where I heard this, but they made the point, you know, that the living stuff, you know, grows right out of the dead stuff. So there's less of like this defined on or off or kind of living or dead or dualistic thing. And it's more of something else, you know, kind of taking place. And that's what I think, to some extent, humans have a hard time like dealing with, you know, and that in trying to create a stable...
Do you think it's inherent to humanity, or is it our civilization? So this is what I've been thinking about, whether or not we think, you know, how we operate is just genetic or inherent, but have we programmed ourselves with culture and civilization, and that's where some of this strange programming is coming from? Like, what, how, you know, let's say OWS is successful. What do we do? Is there like a reset button, you know? It's like, how do you...
What does it have to do with reprogramming oneself? I mean, okay, like you were talking about the stage of analog to digital. In a way, that's the same thing that has happened to Sync, because before you had the analog of turning over the cards with initial intent on, you know, picking up some kind of a synchronicity that happens in the cards that has meaning behind it. Do you know what I mean? And now, instead of actually waiting till we flip the cards, we're trying to, like, push that over into now. Like, and so I feel like all of this is like a reprogramming or a speeding up of the programming that is consciousness. Do you know what I'm saying? The connections between what has meaning and what doesn't, the intervals of time have become shorter and shorter and shorter. And so the secret to reprogramming the whole civilization is reprogramming the individual, or working on your own work, like what I call cleaning your apparatus, or what Gurdjieff said, the good work. I mean, do you guys understand that concept of what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the dilemma, is that to, you know, work on the inward world versus the outward. And I think that, yeah, I mean, they're real big ideas that are kind of hard to tackle, and that we are in the midst of, so it's hard to fully understand the implications of, you know, is the internet going to eventually going to be kind of a liberating medium that's going to, you know, because, I mean, it's, in some ways it's allowed, like, an incredible flow of information that's very liberating and allows, like, further, us to look further into ourselves. But I think when it gets to kind of this hypermedia state of, like, the doubling of information, and that you can essentially map it out to where in the next 5 or 10 years it's going to be doubling every day and then every second and so forth, that when you're in that kind of hypermedia state, what's really important is the internal, because it becomes more or less a mirror, you know? Because if I want to look up anything right now, I can pretty much look it up and find it on the internet, you know. Whether, you know, for a lot of people that gets into, like, strange fetishes or things like that, you know, that they might have thought they were the only person who liked some particular weird fetish, and then suddenly they find full archives of videos about some bizarre things, you know. Or for people doing scholarly research, you can find copies of books, you know, that are out of print and you would have never found in the actual world. So to me it becomes a mirror of whatever is going on internally. So that's what I find, like, the most meaningful changes come from doing internal work, because it's important to have kind of a grounded, centered state. Otherwise you're going to just get lost in this mirror of information.
Labyrinth.
Yeah, it does become that. And I was going to add earlier, I think that in some ways the stability that people, I think there's like an archetypal want for stability that came from being in the womb, you know, kind of that's definitely an archetypal human experience. And it was kind of, you know, it was a pre-life state, but it was also, you know, a totally, like, loving state, and you were totally taken care of and totally safe and comfortable.
It was nothing but change for the organism. So it's interesting, because as you were talking earlier, I was, wrote down, the garden state is a lie. You know, the state of nature has changed. Everything has changed, and so much of our desire is to get back to this nostalgic place or state that isn't real, you know?
Like the way you said nostalgia.
Yeah.
With nothing but growth and change, and every day you're doubling cells, or
you know, growing an arm or losing a tail.
Yeah, and I think that is true. You certainly are the agent of change within the womb environment in this kind of stasis, and there that it allows unfettered growth. But I think it is like a traumatizing to some extent psychologically, that then you're thrust out into a world that's constantly changing around you, and it's easy to almost stay the same, or just you to be then the still factor within this ever-changing outer environment, or to feel alienated, you know. And I think subconsciously that when people are trying to create this stable outer world, which that's what the documentary was kind of getting at, of using computers to create this stable spaceship type environment, that subconsciously kind of...
It detailed how these natural networks do, there are real, where it's not a controlled, like a naturally regulated network, right?
But then at the same time, there's this dark side to it where the computers are used to control groups of people and create a hierarchy and maintain a certain level of order. Sorry.
Yeah, and it's kind of just to preserve the present state. Just to finish out the idea, I think, like, when trying to create this stable or womb-type environment, you actually almost create, like, a tomb rather than a womb. The stability of wanting to make it stable and unchanging, kind of self-regulating thing ends up becoming more along the lines of, like, a cell, prison cell or kind of tomb, rather than the constantly changing kind of natural ecosystem.
But it speaks to the cane kill, you know, the like Gaddafi, where we get into these stagnant government situations where there has to be a revolution because there's no change taking place. We're stuck in like a holding pattern, but it's interesting because it's the cycle where we get change moving, and then all of a sudden we try and create stability again, and then the generals come in and we've got the same crappy world.
You know what's interesting to me is I was listening to Manly P. Hall the other day talk about how revolutions happen in years that were heavy with earthquakes. What does that mean to you guys?
Yeah. I mean, like, I was kind of tracking, after meeting Steve Wilner in Portland, he mentioned, and I don't want to give away his friend's idea, but he mentioned that one of his friends was mapping like the inverse relationship between solar flares and stock market. excuse me. So I was noticing on a couple sites, you know, like on Red Ice, say, it has like the little sun monitor, and there were a tremendous amount of solar flares occurring during kind of more revolution type times, almost in a very like synchronistic way. Like in August, there was August and September, there was like a tremendous amount of like X class, which is the largest solar flare. And during the spring, during the so-called like Arab Spring, there was a tremendous amount of solar flares. So I'm not sure that. Well, there's also the connection that solar flares could potentially be a cause of earthquakes, because there's this huge electromagnetic kind of wave, and it kind of plays, it kind of strums the Earth geomagnetic field like a guitar string, and I think that to some extent can like loosen up areas that are about ready to go, as far as like being on the edge of earthquake. But I think there, to some extent, there was almost like a definite correlation between solar flares and these kind of uprisings, which you could almost kind of imagine the heightened energy from the flare causing like either agitated or like maybe a little bit higher consciousness state within the individual, as like the microcosm of the sun. But so there's definitely like a, to some extent, a correlation, but it isn't necessarily like causation of that.
Well, I guess, I don't know. I guess the big question would be if the revolutions are
the mental state of the Earth calls the solar flare, or the solar flare calls the mental state.
Yeah, and I think it's micro and macro, you know, kind of there's like a holographic synchronistic kind of thing, you know. Like I like the idea that the Earth is becoming more conscious through us, or even that the sun or the solar system is becoming more conscious, you know, that it isn't like, okay, this is the Earth and this is the sun and this is how it's been for billions of years and they're always going to be. I feel like they themselves are in their own way becoming more conscious, and in our own waking up, you know, becoming more conscious or evolving in our own way, that almost creates synchronistic outer things occurring in the same way.
All right, Doug, how much time we got left?
We've got a minute left. Did you have anything you wanted to say, Justin, just to send us out? You just got hit by the solar maximum. I was going to say earlier, 1989 was the solar max year, you know, the Tiananmen Square. 2001, of course, was the solar maximum, and 2012 is, you know, another solar maximum year. It's kind of, I think, in 11-year cycles or something. We lost you, Justin. Go ahead, Will. Oh, that's awesome. See, it has to do with Plato's cave again, you know, this micro-macro. We are just about out of time for this week. It was fun as usual. I always look forward to it Monday night. I'm like, oh, good, I get to have 42 minutes tomorrow.
All right, see you next week.
See you next week. That's it. Take care, everyone.